Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you are the generous sort, you can be like Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John, who all support the podcast on Patreon. Through Patreon, you're able to support the show with either a recurring or one-time donation, which helps us pay for various parts of the show like web hosting or our Zoom subscription. If that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store if you feel inclined. So check it out. This is our first group episode of 2021, and we're really excited for the year. So we thought we'd start out with talking about some of the things outside of the podcast that all four of the hosts are excited about working on in 2021. I guess we'll start with Brett. He's having fun out there in Idaho, and I think some of his excitement might come with finding some trout out in some of those local streams he likes to fish.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Definitely, since I moved out here in late fall and had to get my bearings with my new job and moving around, I've actually moved again ever since I've been out here to be closer to work. So I'm very much looking forward to, in 2021, getting outside more and, like you said, trying to find some trout in some of the local waters. And I've actually been doing a little bit of that here in the winter, which is kind of nice because there's not a lot of fishing pressure, but it's been pretty fun. I'd say work-related things that I'm excited for in 2021. I may have mentioned this on a previous episode, but we did get funding to implement a habitat restoration project. So I'll be able to see that process from, you know, step one to completion. And so that'll be really neat. And it'll tie back into some stuff I want to talk about later, but it'll be another one in a long series of projects in the watershed that I'm working in. So definitely really excited for that as well.
And Julie, do you have anything that you're really looking forward to down there in Florida?
One of the things that I think is really cool about the job that I've been doing for a little while now is that I do get to directly participate in stock assessment process. And I am sort of, you know, the last person to see a lot of the data for a lot of our Southeast marine fisheries for Florida and submit that information to the stock assessment process. So really be at the table where stock assessment is happening, which I think, you know, it's very cool to be able to see and to have worked, I guess, throughout my career in every piece of the puzzle, everything from, you know, collecting the fish to dealing with the data to actually presenting it within the stock assessment process. So that's pretty cool. I really appreciate that about my current job. And I'm excited to participate in more stock assessments through 2021. Some a variety of groupers and snappers in both the Gulf of Mexico and the South Atlantic.
And Sue, your semester probably just recently started the past few weeks. Are you looking forward to anything in your courses you're teaching this semester, or maybe outside of school?
Yeah, I have a lot, Nick. I kind of organized it for our goals and resolutions section, I guess, that all of the things that I'm excited for are also kind of wrapped in with those. So I guess I'll share them for the next segment.
As far as work goes, I'm kind of excited. I've been working on a alternative fisheries management plan, kind of inspired by Jason Schooley and Dennis Garnecchia's paper that came out about bow fishing management. After talking with them, I decided to rebrand our paddlefish and sturgeon committee to alternative fisheries committee. And that includes all traditional non-sport fish is what we call them in Kansas, and trying to develop a management plan that might start including some objectives on maybe gain some information about some of those non-sport fish that we don't really know as much about as we think we do. So I'm excited to get that out and see what the other committee members and the agency thinks about that. Here in about another month and a half, we're going to go out and do our Sauger broodstock collection. So I guess that was right when everything got shut down last year. So I guess I'm excited to get out and see some sauger again and actually produce some fish this year. Last year we were shut down right after we squeezed them all. So, or not right after we collected them all, not after squeezed them. But, and then personally, I guess I'm excited. My daughter's birthday, first birthday, is coming up in a few weeks. So that's pretty exciting. Getting everything ready to host some immediate family come for that. Made her a toy box for her birthday. And as always, I'm looking forward to crappie fishing in the spring when that happens. So
I got to know, does she have any plush paddlefish toys? I know it's your favorite fish and you got to start them young. So any fish toys on the horizon here?
She doesn't have any stuffed paddlefish toys. we did try to get like as many children's books about fish and fishing as we could. Some of them are better quality than others.
That's for sure.
I would not recommend Curious George Goes Fishing. Curious George Goes Fishing is a terrible book. In the end, he decides flying a kite is better than fishing.
Whoa, that's not even close.
Yeah, no. So I also read Curious George Goes to the Aquarium, and he spends most of his time at the aquarium in the penguin exhibit. Like, he doesn't even play with the fish. So. Would not recommend Curious George.
It's weird. At the end of that book, he also determines that flying a kite is more fun than going to the aquarium.
Curious George isn't the role model that we all remember him being. And I'll have to say that as a parent as well. You're like, wait, what? That's not okay. my son recently...
He's a very mischievous one.
Yeah. My son recently has graduated from the Duplos to the full-blown Legos. And we have gotten a boat with scuba divers and sawfish, shark. So we're definitely adding to our ocean and fish collection within the Lego universe.
Nice.
Yeah, Cecilia has some fish puzzles, little Melissa and Doug puzzles, and she got her life jacket, and she has her own little fishing pole, which she can hold, but she doesn't know how to operate or anything. But looking forward to getting her out on the boat this spring. Last year, she was just a little too small to take out on the boat, but hopefully this summer to get her out a little bit.
My son just turned 4, and at least once every couple of weeks, he's like, "Mom, why don't we own a boat?"
Like, well, if you want to pay for it. Hun.
They're a lot of work. Yeah. We need to get a boat, Mom.
I guess that's your child's goal for 2021 is to get a boat. But Julie, do you have any goals other than not getting a boat for your son?
I mean, it's definitely in my 2021 goals is getting a boat, but I don't think that one's going to be realized. I have been thinking about there's a business here that's called Freedom Boat Club. I don't know if it's around the rest of the country or whatever, but basically it's like boat time sharing. And I'm definitely intrigued by that since they do all the maintenance and everything. But it's a little expensive. But I would, that'd be pretty sweet.
That's actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah. Basically, you know, they own a fleet of boats and then you sign up for time on them or whatever. So maybe sometime in 2021, we'll see. Work-wise and sort of science-wise goals, I would say, I definitely have one more chapter for my dissertation that I really want to get out into the world. It's sitting on my co-author's desk right now. So hopefully I can bother him into, you know, signing off on it and we can move forward with the review process on that. I definitely want to go do some diving in 2021. I only got out and dove I did 2 dives in all of 2020. So hopefully 2021, we can do a little better than that. But of course that is intensity of COVID dependent as well. So We'll see. Do some more paddle boarding. This is a good time of year for it right now. Right now it's 70 degrees and like super flat calm. So I might run out my door and go paddle boarding right after this. We'll see.
Wow. I can't imagine. That's crazy.
This is why we live here. This is why we have snowbirds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So those are some of my 2021 goals.
Well, one of my goals would not be to stand up paddleboard the Clearwater or the Snake River, or else you would see me on the news, but I don't know in what kind of condition I would be in. But I have some goals that are, you know, pretty similar to Julie's in some ways. So a week ago, I got confirmation that my first chapter of my thesis is going to be published in Transactions. So I am super excited to get that out into the world. And then we're going to start revising the second chapter and hopefully get that out. So 2021 goal, for sure, finish up publishing my master's thesis work, which I got plenty of time to do, hopefully, since it's only January now. but yeah, it feels amazing to get the first one out. And so looking forward to digging into the second one and making it better. Work-wise, I guess I sort of, you know, let the cat out of the bag, but I'm really excited to be able to be a part of, and, you know, a bigger capacity, my first stream restoration project. I've been a part of monitoring sort of projects afterwards in some undergrad research that I did, but never really on the ground and sort of working with the construction phases. Obviously I won't be doing any of the larger construction because we contract that stuff out, but it'll be really cool to sort of see day by day, you know, before, during, and after. Really excited for that. And then, yeah, personally, again, I'm just have some goals that I would like, some angling goals that I don't know if they're particularly relevant for fisheries science, but essentially I want to try and catch a native trout out of every sort of major watershed in region 2 of Idaho, which is where I work. So those are my sort of science work and personal goals. And then I guess another one would be, I've noticed that I haven't been reading very much ever since I graduated from grad school. So trying to get back into reading, I have a couple of books on the docket that I want to get notched into the belt. So I don't know. I know we had an episode talking about books a little while back, but you know, maybe we could revisit that at some point, because there's definitely some new ones that I've been seeing that people have been recommending, and maybe want to try and look into that too. But Susie, it sounds like you were sitting on some pretty cool information, or wanted to talk about your goals, because that's why you were so excited for 2021. So what do you have coming on soon?
Well, first I want to say congratulations on that paper. I can't wait to see it come out, and I hope that you let us all know when it is out so we can read it. But that's so cool, Brett.
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Right. So goals, got a lot of goals. Actually, going through all my goals, I started to get a little bit anxious about them, but I'll still forge ahead. So I have a whole suite of new and enhanced courses that I'm teaching. So that's kind of taking up a lot of my time, is revamping and rebooting those for a new region and a new student population. Many of my former students were going to be game wardens. And so I focus more on issues like pertinent to that region, New England dam removals, put and take fisheries, and preserving rare and endangered salmonids. But in Arkansas, more of these students will become wildlife and fisheries biologists and educators. So there's more of a need to really dig deep and address like the nuances of fisheries techniques and management. And more regional ecology and ichthyology. So that actually takes up a lot of my time. So I hope to be in an even better place for those courses next year. And then I'm starting some stream connectivity and fish assemblage research. I have an undergraduate student, Alyssa Mostrom, who is going to work on investigating fish passage through culverts, low water concrete barriers, and bridges in Ozark streams with visual implant elastomer tags. And then I'm also kind of working with the Forest Service on that. And then one of the things that I'm really excited about is we've started some fish breeding projects here at Tech. And I have two undergraduate students working on that for research credit, Ethan Dodson and Trey Welch. And ultimately, my goal is to breed fish for conservation purposes. So one of our species is the pea puffer, which is really popular in the aquarium trade, but it's considered vulnerable in the wild due to unsustainable harvest and habitat degradation. So, you know, I hope that these efforts enhance our aquaculture course, which I should be teaching next year, and just kind of provide students with projects they're interested in, because I started realizing that a lot of the students that ended up in my courses found their way there because they had kept fish in tanks growing up. And that was really what drew them in. And so I wanted to kind of incorporate that element, but also do it with like conservation and ecology in mind. And then of course, many students end up working in hatcheries, and I think this can help prepare them for that, but still link in with the conservation aspect. And of course, it really enhances our ichthyology course because then they can actually see some of the fish that we talk about. And then another professor here who's actually a wildlife professor is really excited about using some of these species for his animal behavior courses, because we're also hoping to breed some really cool cichlids, like shell breeding cichlids and mouth brooding species. So I'm actually really pumped up about that. And pea puffers are like the cutest fish ever. So, and they just came in this past week. And then I'm still working on a project analyzing all papers that have ever been published and transactions that I've kind of shelved for a little while with some colleagues. And then also revamping one of my papers for my dissertation. So that's a lot of it. And then Drew Banta Winters, AFS's policy director, sent me an email last week to ask me if I had any spare time to help with some stuff. And of course I said yes, because I can't turn Drew down for anything. So I'm really pretty curious to see what she has in mind. But yeah, so maybe you can see why I'm a little bit anxious about the length of my list, but nevertheless, it's all really cool stuff. So I'm just really excited about all those projects.
That was your 5-year list, right?
No, listen, we have to have a show now in December, and gotta give some progress updates. And so I realize it's like, if you tell everybody that you're gonna do this, you're actually gonna have to do it. So it's good. I'm going to be working. But yeah, and actually, since we got the fish, it's really hard not to just be in the fish room, like working with these cool little critters. But, you know, crunching numbers is important too. So I'll be doing that as well.
Kind of along the same lines as everyone here so far, one of my goals for 2021 is to get a paper out. I have one in review right now that over some gillnet evaluation work I did. Kind of when I first started here in Kansas. So hopefully get those comments back soon and get corrected hopefully it's accepted and get back out there. But I guess goal in all, if it isn't accepted, get published somewhere in 2021. And then other work stuff. Spent a lot of the past few summers sampling my blue catfish on my reservoir with float lines or jug lines. And well, I find good numbers of them that way, or at least better numbers. It's not very comparable with what the other biologists are doing, so I can't really compare my data with the other guys, not too many others run jug lines. So one of my goals for 2021 is to really devote more time to low frequency electrofishing for blue catfish and really get a good idea on the population I have and get a more comparable number to some of the other reservoirs. And because starting to get more and more pressure on updating the regulation right now, has a protective regulation while we develop the population, and getting a lot of cry from anglers that it's time to switch that to a more trophy fish regulation. So try to figure out how to get more information to make the best decision possible when that time comes. It's one of my goals for 2021. And then to my reservoir, I've mentioned it before, it's a popular crappie reservoir. And so another goal is to be put a lot of artificial habitat out for the crappie. Started making these PVC crappie jacks. Completely stole it from someone's design on crappie.com forum. So I really like it. It's pretty easy to make. I can fit a whole bunch of them in the boat when I go to set them out. So hopefully going to build and set 500 of them out this summer if I can successfully navigate the state purchasing system. So that's my goals, I think.
Those are great, Nick. And what was the change that you made after the bow fishing paper in that interview?
So we rebranded our paddlefish and sturgeon committee to alternative fisheries committee. So that includes bow fishing, snagging, which was paddlefish primarily, bow fishing, snagging, gigging, spearing. I don't know how many people spear in Kansas, but it's in our regulations. And there's a growing more, there's, I don't know if growing, but there's starting to be a more vocal group of anglers that are into recreational carp fishing like Dion is. So looking into some of that stuff and and down the road, if we want to start managing for trophy carp or how, or just managing some of these non-sport fish. You can't see the air quotes, but they're there. So I think that's a big task a lot of states might be looking at in the next few years.
I think that's fabulous that you made that change. Yeah, I read that paper after you mentioned it in that interview, and it's like 50 pages. So I thank you for taking up that couple hours out of my life, but it was really worth it. And I was just dumbstruck, just flabbergasted that we don't really manage for bow fishing really anywhere, or hardly anywhere. So I think that's really cool that you are going to look into that more. Do you regulate that type of fishing in Kansas at all?
Bow fishing? No. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have to have a fishing license, and they're restricted on what fish they can shoot. It's mostly the normal, again, air quotes, non-sport fish, you know, buffaloes, carp, gar. I think in Kansas, sturgeon, shovelnose sturgeon are listed as a non-sport fish, but I don't think they're a target for bow fishing. They'd have to be on the Kansas River anyway to get those. But it's mostly the traditional non-sport fish that they can target, and they can take as many as they want. They can do whatever they want with them. Wanton waste doesn't apply to non-sport fish in Kansas, so they can leave them on the bank, and all they could get labeled with was littering. So that's one thing that I'm hoping to change first with this committee, is kind of rebranding some of our regulations to make it a little bit more protective of these fish, so people aren't just killing for no reason.
Yeah, it's a lot of the students here are really interested in that sport, and so it's definitely something that people really like to do. But it is shocking that it's not something that we really regulate, even though, wasn't it the buffalo that's one of the oldest freshwater species on earth? Or
yeah, has the oldest freshwater teleost.
Yeah,
how they labeled it, 112 years of age.
Yeah, really fascinating. Well, that's cool. That's so neat. And so do you think you would have done that had you not interviewed them for the pod?
I don't think so. I mean, I was planning on, we don't have a current paddlefish management plan in Kansas, so I was planning on doing that anyway. writing a management plan, but now it's just adding those other species and kind of making it more broad. So it's a little bit more work, but I mean, I was going to be writing a management plan from scratch anyway. So went ahead and went with it.
That's great. Well, it sounds like you have an ambitious year ahead of you as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I also forgot I have another project that kicked off at the end of my gillnet one. So looking at blue catfish stress and live wells. So that's hopefully going to be wrapping up this year. That's when the funding finishes up for it, or the funding for the field stuff. So going to build some fake live wells and put fish in them and check their stress before and after and see how they do in different conditions. And maybe at the end of that, come up with some regulations to, I guess, regulate what our blue catfish tournament anglers, their live well size and what kind of supplemental support they have for the fish, like aerators or oxygen tanks. So looking at some of that stuff, because they're starting to get wanting a tournament pass so they weigh in fish inside of slot limits or less than the legal limit as long as they're being released. We have that for black bass tournaments now. They want the same thing for catfish, but the bass guys have a whole lot of regulations on what they need to do as far as tournament handling. So trying to figure out some of that stuff for the catfish guys, so if we decide to give them a tournament pass, they have that. We have that information to say, well, you have to start requiring this of all your anglers. So hopefully that project comes up with some of the answers we want and not just kind of saying no significance, but we'll find out this summer.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Are you seeing really a lot of growth in that particular event?
Yeah, the blue catfish tournaments, I guess I would consider them growing. In the past, I mean, on my reservoir, we usually have just one a year. Milford Reservoir, about an hour and a half down the road, it was the first lake in Kansas to get stocked with blue catfish. And so it has the most established population, and they see a handful of tournaments a year. And last year they held the Cabela's King Cat Classic, which is like the Cabela's Series Super Bowl, their championship. So they held that, a nationwide tournament. And Cabela's held two tournaments there, one being the championship, one other one, and then one on Tuttle Creek, which is another Kansas reservoir. So, I mean, that big national series held three in Kansas last year. There's plenty on the Kansas River and some on the Missouri River. We have a little stretch of that in Kansas. So there's three or four, maybe even up to five different catfish tournament series just in Kansas alone. So, I mean, it's not as popular as bass fishing, but it's starting to get there with all of our Kansas reservoirs having developing blue catfish populations.
That's neat. That's so great that you're so responsive to that change and interest in the angling community. It's awesome.
Brett, you kind of hinted at in one of your goals that you were one to read more. And I guess that's always one of my resolutions. And I guess depending on how you define them, resolutions and goals can be a little bit different. But one of my resolutions every year is to read at least one book a month. And I guess so far in 2021, I'm already on my fourth book. So I don't know if I'm picking easy books or short books, but I guess, do any of you have resolutions outside of your goals that you try to accomplish every year, whether it be work or personal?
I started a spreadsheet for reading this year, actually. So I'm keeping myself a little bit more accountable. And it's mostly reading papers. But I often read just watered down versions, like news releases about papers rather than the paper itself. So I'm trying to kind of hold myself more accountable to that. And when I got my new office, my predecessor, Dr. Joe Stuckel, he didn't move out his stuff. I guess he moved out 8 wheelbarrow loads, but all my shelves are full and they're full of journals that go back about 30 years. And but I haven't thrown them out, right? Or recycled them, because I am really you know, trying to force myself on days when I have like just an hour or something to just start going through the shelves and pulling stuff down and just reading anything that interests me. So it's similar to your reading goal, Nick, but just more like papers.
Julie or Brett, do either of you have kind of resolutions outside of the goals that you try to accomplish?
No. Not
really. No. Julie from the back.
Nope. No.
just
staying alive.
Trying to keep us, the three of us, going.
Yeah, I guess I feel like I've been talking about this maybe a little bit today already, but one thing I did start for 2021 is I've now started to become even more of a nerd. So I started a fishing log. So now every time I go fishing, instead of kind of just like figuring it out as I go and then kind of coming home and maybe posting a couple photos, maybe trying to go that extra level, especially now that I tie flies, and I've started angling logs. So trying to keep track of discharge and weather and previous maybe weeks, weather or flow events, and then sort of writing that all down, what I used, was it successful or not, and maybe try and take more, I guess, data, if you will, to try and see if there's anything I can keep track of and improve. But yeah, obviously that's personal and fishing related again, and not so much, you know, fishery science, but it, in a way it kind of is science. I'm collecting data and maybe hopefully collecting enough for it to be useful at some point. And then other resolution is, yeah, what I really would like to do is, this is my first time working in systems that have anadromous species that are quite, well, I would say important, but I think that kind of waters it down a little bit. They're very well known, they're well renowned, but also they're sort of heavily managed and relied upon depending on, you know, what stakeholder group you're in. So I think one of the things that my resolution, and this is maybe just for this year, but I really just want to get to know sort of the history and the backstory of the Pacific Northwest a little bit more as it relates to me trying to get better at my job. yeah, there's just so much, I guess, politics and history, and there's so much that goes into sort of anadromous Pacific salmon and steelhead that it's kind of made my head spin a little bit ever since I got out here. So that might be more of a goal, I suppose, but really just trying to get to know this area better as it relates to hopefully getting better at my job. But that's it. 2021 is still somewhat of a blank slate a little bit in terms of exactly what I want to do.
You're a naturalist, Brett. You're like a Thoreau of Idaho out there.
That might be a little too kind, I guess, but my first like aquatic related job was actually in macroinvertebrates. So, I mean, I helped a PhD student collect, you know, aquatic macros, and then we'd, you know, preserve them, bring them back, and I would sort them out by order. And then he was an absolute guru with taxonomy. And he was, you know, mounting individual chironomids and identifying them to species. I mean, he was amazing with that stuff, and I never got to that level, but yeah, just trying to bring all that back to, you know, what I'm doing on the river, I suppose, and instead of just ignoring it, like sometimes I feel like I did, even though I had worked in both of those realms, for whatever reason, when I would go out on my personal time, it's kind of just like, you know, I kind of know this and that, but never really put it to, I guess, memory or pen to paper type of stuff. So,
yeah, well, in this field, I think it's normal for your passions in your normal everyday life to kind of just bleed right into what you do for your job, right? Mm. And one can inform the other. and that's fine. You know, that's exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited for sure. I definitely saw myself not getting outside as much during grad school. So that's one thing I've definitely owe it to myself to just get out and about more. And especially while I live here, there's a lot of cool public land. So just going to go search around, I suppose, this year.
Yeah, so I guess we've kind of talked about what we're looking forward to in 2021 and maybe some of the goals we have that we might not be looking forward to accomplish, the work that goes into accomplishing all those goals, but the outcomes that come from them. But another thing we planned on talking about today was kind of some fishy news that we might have been seeing in the past month or in the recent that we haven't talked about on the podcast. So I guess, Sue, you had the most of it, the most headlines that any of us came with prepared with. So would you like to start with maybe one of the stories you'd like to talk about?
Right. So I just told y'all that it was because I couldn't sleep the other night. So I was like, well, I might as well look this up since we're going to talk with each other. So one of the things I thought was neat was some researchers in Oregon were using eDNA to find the highest upstream extent of, I think it was cutthroat trout, as versus backpack shocking. And that was really poignant to me because I actually recently recorded an electrofishing pod with Jim Reynolds and Alan Temple and one of our students here, Emily Johnigan, but also because the first time I'd ever seen a trout's vertebral column break from electrofishing was in that region. And so I thought it was really kind of neat that somebody was really trying to figure out how to, you know, survey for them and, you know, to protect those streams and protect those populations, but not hurt them. So good work there. And then some other things that were really interesting was, so with the African cichlids, they thought that one of the things that helped them speciate was differences in how they regulated genes related to vision. So as I understand it, they didn't necessarily have different genes for vision, but they regulated them, you know, when they used them or how they used them was different. And that helped them speciate, which is really kind of neat. And then I, you know, the most mind-blowing article was that these electric knife fish, I think, was it South America? They were hunting in packs, tetras. And so it was quite a few of them would herd these tetras and then they would break into smaller groups and shock them. And I think they were capable of producing over 800 volts. And they'd stun the tetras and then eat them. But, you know, fish showing any kind of herding behavior is amazing. And then just, you know, using those really incredible and unique skills to be able to stun their prey is just really mind-blowing. So those were some of the news articles that really struck me, no pun intended, lately. Some things I found fascinating.
Yes, Brett, do you have any fish news that you'd like to share that maybe you found interesting?
Yeah, well, I guess mine are a bit more regional, but our regional communications manager did a cool series reflecting back on 2020. I know it's been a tough year for many, but I think she did a great job of kind of trying to find some highlights from the different fisheries projects within the region that I work in anyway, which is the Clearwater region, and, you know, kind of put out small little blog posts, I guess, if you will, on the Idaho Fish and Game website. So you can definitely go check those out. But I think one that was particularly significant, especially, I guess, for what I do and where I live, is that for only the second time in the last 100 years, with last year previous to 2020, being the first Idaho Fish and Game provided harvest opportunities for both hatchery and wild adult fall Chinook salmon in the Snake and Clearwater rivers. And so I know their recovery is, you know, a long shot of being, you know, completed or solidified into the future. But I thought that was kind of a significant highlight for a rather gloomy year, that fishery was opened for, you know, in the past 100 years, only twice, and then two of those years were here recently. So that was something that anglers in the region were able to get involved with. And there was tons of coordination between Idaho and Washington, Oregon, the Nez Perce tribe, as well as NOAA fisheries to make that happen. So I thought that was really cool. And then one, I guess, even more specific to what I've been and will be working on while at my current position is that within the Potlatch River watershed, the project that was completed in 2020 now completes close to 3 contiguous miles of steelhead habitat restored in various projects in partnership with private landowners, where they have done lots of large wood implementation and to increase habitat complexity and cover, which are some of the things that are limiting factors in the watershed that I work in. So there's a whole series just in this region, and I'm sure some other folks around the state have written similar, what they call press releases on their website. So if you're interested, you can definitely go to the Fish and Game website, and they have tons of pertinent and cool articles that you can browse through. But those were two that I thought were pretty significant, or, you know, hit close to home, and I thought maybe folks would be interested in. Julie, do you have any more tropical or warm weather related news down in Florida?
Well, so I was actually going to talk about a paper that I finally got published in the last week. It did not make it into the news services, but it is a brand new paper that got out. And so I was pretty proud of that. It was in the Marine Ecology Progress series, which, by the way, is a dream organization to work with. They have like real editors and copy editing and everything like that. It was amazing to work with them through the publication process. But it was one portion of my PhD and using the stable isotopes from the fish eye lenses, I was able to make an entire record of the diets and movements of about 90 fish coming from two different species, and compare and contrast what those two different species were doing, which is also really interesting and important because most of the time people think of these species as being relatively similar. They both kind of live in the Gulf of Mexico, on the continental shelf. They both kind of dig their homes. They supposedly stick around them, but we actually found through isotopes and showed definitively that one of them really is doing that, is staying home pretty much their whole life. And the other one is actually moving huge, long, long distances over the course of their lifespan. They're spending a few months in relatively shallow water as they're while they're little, and then progressively moving offshore as they get bigger. And that was something that we could see really definitively within those stable isotopes. So pretty exciting. Also, just kind of developing that method, it's still a very, very new technique and something that we're still trying to develop how to interpret it. So now that's out there, and hopefully other people can continue to build on what we started.
Dang.
Julie, are you going to tell us what the species are, or is that like a surprise?
Yeah, no. Tilefish is one, and they are the ones that kind of dig their own burrows and live deep in these burrows. And the other one is called red grouper. And they like to kind of dig out little depressions in the in kind of sandy sediment. Are the really interesting thing about the continental shelf where I live, the West Florida shelf, is that it's actually a drowned reef complex. When sea levels were much lower, there used to be kind of coral reefs basically all the way around Florida almost. And now, you know, it's been underwater a long time, and that most of that reef complex has been covered over with sand. And so somehow the red grouper are actually able to find these little pillars of carbonate, you know, hard rock that's kind of like sticking up close to the surface of the sand. And they excavate these depressions like 6 to 10 feet across that they will associate with and usually stay around and stuff. And there's actually still a lot of work to be done in terms of what else uses those areas and why, and all these other kinds of things that we haven't answered yet. But one of the things that people have always kind of like assumed about them is that they basically just spend their life hanging around one little depression. But it seems as though pretty definitively through their isotopes that they are moving well inshore to very shallow water when they're little, just as they're, you know, maturing from larvae into juveniles, and then spending probably at least a year kind of slowly moving back offshore again to where you can find the adults.
Dang, that's amazing. And you're able to publish that. Mm-hmm. And now I have to go read it. It's like, that's...
You're welcome to. I'll send you the PDF.
Yeah, please do. That's super cool.
Yeah, show notes. Put it in the show notes.
It's so much different. You know, everything about that is like the habitat and the species are so different from what I'm used to on a day-to-day basis that it'll be very refreshing to get back to some salt, because I haven't been to South Carolina in quite some time. And we only
Yeah, it's very much the opposite of, you know, a lot of the species that you're dealing with, right? They're, yours are born up the river and then move out to the ocean. Ours kind of end up doing the opposite. They're born way offshore, you know, at the edge of the shelf, and then kind of come into the seagrass beds and those areas to kind of grow up and then start moving back out to their adult habitats.
So, Julie, I have a follow-up question for that, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
So, I looked these fish up and they don't look anything like each other. They're not in the same family. So what was the reason that folks assumed that they were pretty much similar?
Just that their habits, or I guess their behaviors, are pretty similar. Just that they're both kind of digging these holes and creating their own homes in the bottom. They're heavily associated with one area of the bottom through, you know, extended periods of time.
Yeah, it's really cool. And what was the biggest difference that you found between them?
Isotopically, just that you could see very definitively in those profiles of the lenses that tilefish really are not deviating. They're very steady. They're very consistent. They're always kind of doing the same thing throughout their whole life. And red grouper really make big changes in sort of where they are and what they're eating and stuff like that.
That's awesome. Yeah, and here it says...
And those are, I mean, these are two relatively known species, you know, and we have some inferential evidence, but just being able to put that together from individual, you know, records from single individuals can show you that entire lifetime.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It says that the tilefish make villages. Is that true?
In some areas. I'm not sure that we have a lot of that in the Gulf of Mexico, but yeah, I know they're widely distributed in relatively deep shelf edge waters all the way up to New England. And so I think in some of those areas, they're pretty well known to live in groups and stuff. And I'm not sure that anyone knows that specifically about what they're doing in the Northern Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Great work, Julie.
Thanks.
All right. So bringing it back around to Nick in the Midwest region. What's going on in Kansas? Or do you have a more exotic story for us somewhere outside of the Midwest?
I do have one exotic story. I guess it's not a very big news story, but it's kind of an event that kind of re-sparks a conversation. Over in Europe, the Wells catfish, the giant catfish that they have over there, was documented leaping out of the water and onto shore and eating pigeons that wander along the shoreline eating. And so this fish, the article in National Geographic described as this giant catfish catapulting itself out of the water and snatching a pigeon before hurling itself back into the river. And then that in itself is, I guess, kind of clickbaity news, but the whole article goes on to talk about how these fish are kind of stable and not really much of a threat in their native rivers, but because of their large size, anglers stock them all over rivers in Europe and have since kind of wreaked havoc on some of the fish in those rivers that they aren't native to. One of them being the Atlantic salmon. And the article claims that they like keying in on these migratory fishes like the Atlantic salmon and really wreak havoc on those. And so a lot like the United States, we have trouble with invasive non-native species. They have the same thing over there. It just happens to be a giant pigeon eating catfish. So that's a pretty interesting story just because a giant fish leaps out of the water and eats a pigeon, but has a nice backstory to it
too. And it really is just another example of why fish are better than birds. So team fish.
Team fish.
For all you Twitter followers out there.
Exactly.
Definitely. It's scary. You got to watch small children around these things. You guys are going to have to Google it and watch the videos. Oh my gosh. It's quite violent too. Oh, the ones I'm watching though, it gets away, but man, scary stuff. That's awesome, Nick. Good one.
Yeah. And it probably another one to have it. It probably won't make the news, but it could have if it ended up being true. Friday, right before noon, I was sitting in my basement office and got a call from my supervisor that an angler had reached out to him that he had what he thought was a state record short-nosed gar. And this isn't a very odd complaint. I guess they had one right before I was hired on in Kansas that they determined was a hybrid. And then my second year here, I verified what the current state record is for a short-nosed gar. But this one was rather large. He claimed it to be well over the 9.64 pounds that the current record is, and claimed it to be about 50 inches long. And so I told him to go get weighed on a certified scale and we'd come look at it. And so he brought it back to my boat shed where I looked at it and took all the measurements. And there's a lot overlapping. So if you're looking at it from the perspective of that it is a short nose gar, it kind of fit the bill. But if you go thinking it is a long nose gar, it also fits some of those numbers. And ultimately ended up being a long nose gar that had part of its snout broken off long ago and it had healed, so it wasn't fresh or anything. And I didn't notice that until I got home and looked at the pictures on my computer that it was a long nose gar. I mean, every time I look at it now, I feel more and more stupid for forever even thinking it was a short nose gar, but it is a long nose gar. Have to break his heart on Monday, call him and tell him it's not going to be a record. But it would have been, it's hard to find, but the one I did find on the Boat Fishing Association of America's website, it would have been a world record short nose gar shot by a bow. So a little bit more stakes on the line than just saying it's a state record here in Kansas. So, but it ended up being a long nose gar, so not really newsworthy anymore, but a fun little story that I live tweeted on Twitter. So
just send him the MP3 of this conversation and let that be how he finds out. he'll learn lots of cool fish facts and then the not so fun part. Yeah. That way it won't be as awkward for you.
Yeah, well, he was standing there when I was doing all the measurements and I had all my keys flipped and I was like writing down what I need to measure and what it should be for short-nosed gar. And all of it fit except for like the number of scales from the vent to the midline of the back. Mm. And that, so I was like, well, it looks hybridish, if not long-nosed gar, but all these numbers check out. But I didn't care to look at the numbers for long-nosed gar, which it also fit into. And then every time I look at the picture, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's definitely a long-nosed gar. So got tricked into, got tricked by telling myself I was looking at a short-nosed gar when, and then I had to convince myself it wasn't, when I should have gone in thinking I need to figure out what this fish was. So that was a fun little Friday afternoon adventure.
Yeah, it can be hard when you think it's one species and it's really another. I have a question about long-nosed gar, though. What is the point of that really long nose? I actually have a Tom O'Leary print of that fish up on my office wall because I just love them. But why such a long, skinny snout?
Solomon, if you're listening, make sure you reply to this on Twitter and answer that question.
Yeah. Because all the other species have much blunter snouts, you know, and you would think that they'd get damaged from time to time. So I don't know, just kind of your story made me think about like, well, why isn't that happening more often that it breaks off or gets really damaged, you know? But so you didn't tell the guy over the weekend or the.
No, I let him have over the weekend to kind of to gloat in it. We're supposed to hold the application for 30 days before it becomes official or anything anyway. So I didn't want to call him Friday evening and tell him, oh, sorry, and then have him have a terrible weekend. But the way he was talking, he knows where all the big fish are. He thinks he'd be able to break it again. So I don't know. A lot of anglers talk a big game, but he seemed to know what he was talking about. He's even curious about getting his own certified scale to weigh his own record fish. So,
yeah, I was just going to ask you about that because I was reading about different record fish in different states. And, like, where does one go to find one?
To find a certified scale?
Mm-hmm.
I guess nowadays it's kind of hard to find someone that will let you bring a fish in and put it on a scale. I guess like grocery stores don't want you to haul fish. I mean, Dillon's or Kroger's isn't going to want you to haul a 48-inch long-nosed gar through their store to plop it on the meat counter. So it's kind of difficult to find somewhere. So I was having a difficulty trying to tell people where to go get fish weighed because I do get a handful of them every year. And so I called the state's measure and weights division and was like asked if I could get a list of people with certified scale in the Topeka area, and they kind of said, yeah, it might take a while though, what's it for? And I explained it, and they're like, oh, well, all you really need to do is find anyone that sells things by the pound, or you could even just get a scale. The scales aren't that expensive. You just have to buy a legal for trade scale. She said most people have them for farmers markets. Some people sell stuff by the pound at farmers markets. And the scales are, I mean, I ended up buying one for myself for work that was $300, and it does resolution down to 5 grams. So it's not the best for field work, but it is certifiable for records up to 30 pounds. So, and since it's a state agency, it's certified, or I get checked and regulated for free, but I don't know what it costs for other people. A bait shop in town ended up getting one. But I guess in short, anywhere that sells stuff by the weight should have a scale that's certified legal for trade. So
sounds like it might be something that you want to know where one exists before you go after a record. Like if you're going to go after a record, maybe. So you're not driving around with stinky fish in your car.
Yeah, and it's not so bad if you are like have a crappie or a bass or a smaller fish like that, that you could like put in a giant cooler and haul around and keep alive for a while. But I've had at least two calls about a state record blue catfish caught on the one on the Kansas and one on the Missouri River. And the Kansas one, they were able to track down their own scale, but the Missouri River one, they're hauling around in a 55 barrel drum and trying to figure out a place to get weighed. And I don't know if they ever did end up finding a place. I never got called after they got the fish weighed. So I don't know if they just gave up or realized it was too small after getting it weighed, but never heard back from them. So, I mean, if you're going after big fish like that, it'd definitely be smart to know where you could and couldn't take a fish before you catch one.
That's awesome. They're still out there driving around looking for scales somewhere.
They could be. They're just making a wider and wider circle trying to find a place to get this giant 103-pound catfish weighed.
Was that really how much you think it weighed?
Well, the state record in Kansas is 102.8, so it would have to be bigger than that.
That's awesome. Okay, that great stories, Nick. Good. Lots of mental imagery there.
Well, like I said in the beginning, all four of us are interested in seeing where the show goes in 2021 and looking forward to some of the episodes that we have planned putting out, but we don't have the whole year planned. So if you want to be on the podcast or know somebody or something that would make a great topic or guest for the show, reach out to us at beaguest@thefisheriespodcast.com or any of our social media. We're pretty responsive to all of the messages we get. So if you want to be on the show, just reach out. And if you would like to get a hold of us, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, like I said, at Fisheries Pod, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks available on Teespring. Thank you for listening to the 106th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember to know where you're going to weigh your record fish, hide your children from Wells Catfish, and read a book.